Imagine waking up one morning and noticing a slight twinge in your shoulder.
Yeah, just a bit of stiffness.
Exactly. Nothing major. You figure you slept on it funny or maybe overdid it carrying groceries.
Right.
But over the next few weeks, that stiffness doesn't fade. It actually gets worse. Reaching for a coffee cup sends this like sharp jolt down your
I guess, yeah,
arm.
it becomes a full-on ordeal.
Putting on a jacket becomes a massive, painful chore, and eventually your shoulder just locks. It stops moving almost entirely.
It's brutal.
So you head to the physio or the doctor, expecting them to say you tore a rotator cuff or injured a ligament, a pure mechanical injury.
Which is what we've all been taught to expect.
Right. But what if the reason your arm is locked up has nothing to do with how you lifted a box and everything to do with a stressed out, overwhelmed brain?
It requires a pretty radical shift in how we view physical pain, honestly.
Yeah.
We're so heavily conditioned to view the human body as this simple machine. A pulley snaps, a hinge rusts, a gear gets
A
jammed.
very mechanical view.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But human biology is vastly more complex and, frankly, a lot more sensitive than a mechanical engine.
Which brings us to the mission for this deep dive. You've brought us a stack of fascinating research today, and we're going to explore the unexpected, slightly mind-bending link between emotional trauma, the immune system, and a notoriously painful condition known as frozen shoulder.
Or adhesive capsulitis, yeah.
Right. And to get to the bottom of this for you, we are pulling from standard clinical overviews, places like StatPearls, the Cleveland Clinic, and the Mayo Clinic, just to, ground us in the medical reality.
Which is important.
Definitely. But we are also weaving in some newer, really paradigm-shifting research. We've got a massive binational study published in Science Direct, some Mendelian randomization data, and a paper from Frontiers in Physiology that basically, well, it throws the traditional mechanical playbook out the window.
Yeah, that Frontiers paper is particularly disruptive
It really is.
because it forces us to look past the shoulder itself. It argues that treating a frozen shoulder by only looking at the shoulder is, it's like trying to fix a software glitch by staring at your computer monitor.
Oh, that's a good way to put it.
You have to examine the entire systemic environment, starting with the patient's mental state.
Okay, let's unpack this because before we can get into the software, the mind-body connection,
Yeah.
we do need to understand the hardware.
Right, the anatomy.
Yeah, what is physically happening inside that joint when it decides to go on strike?
Well, the shoulder is a ball and socket joint, and it's wrapped in a strong capsule of connective tissue.
Okay.
In a healthy state, this capsule is flexible. It allows for the massive range of motion we have in our arms, and it's filled with synovial fluid.
Which is like the lubricant, right?
Spot on. Think of synovial fluid as high-grade engine oil that keeps the cartilage gliding smoothly.
But with adhesive capsulitis, that entire system degrades.
It does.
The connective tissue of the capsule thickens. It becomes rigid and highly inflamed. And then these thick bands of scar tissue adhesions start forming across the joint.
Yeah, and at the same time, that vital synovial fluid actually decreases.
So it's drying up.
The joint is quite literally drying out and cementing itself shut from the inside.
Wow.
And it's a notoriously grueling process. The clinical timeline is typically broken into three stages.
Right, the freezing, frozen, and thawing stages.
Exactly. First is the freezing stage. This can last anywhere from 2 to 9 months.
9 months, just of it getting worse.
Yeah. The pain is usually severe, it gets worse at night, and your mobility just slowly drains away,
And then you enter the frozen stage.
which drags on for another 4 to 12 months.
So you're already potentially a year in at this point.
Easily. The acute pain might dial back a bit here, but the stiffness is absolute. Basic daily tasks, brushing your teeth, reaching for a seatbelt, washing your hair, they become monumental
Oh,
obstacles.
and then finally there's the thawing stage, right?
Yes. Movement gradually returns over 5 to 24 months.
Okay.
But here is the stark reality. This whole thing is a 1 to 3 year ordeal, and up to 40% of patients never regain their full normal range of motion.
40%, that's huge.
Yeah, they are left with a permanent physical restriction.
Now, historically, the medical field has blamed a few specific physical risk factors for this, haven't they?
They have, yeah.
Like, it predominantly hits females between the ages of 40 and 60. And we know prolonged immobility is a huge trigger. Like, if you break your arm and wear a sling for a couple of months, your risk
That's
skyrockets.
right.
And there's a massive link to systemic diseases, specifically diabetes. The Mayo Clinic notes that up to 20% of people with frozen shoulder are diabetic.
Right. Those are the established textbook correlations.
But I've always struggled with that purely mechanical explanation.
How so?
Well, let's say we picture the joint capsule as a shrink-wrapped padage that gets heated up and pulls tighter and tighter around the joint.
Okay, good visual.
If this is purely a mechanical issue caused by lack of movement or purely a blood sugar issue from diabetes, why do some people bounce back to full mobility in a year while 40% end up with a chronic lifelong restriction?
That's the big question.
If the physical triggers are identical, why is the healing process so wildly inconsistent?
Well, the variation in healing tells us we are missing a variable.
Right.
And a massive clue to what that missing variable might be emerged during a very specific high-stress global event, the COVID-19 pandemic.
Oh, man, the pandemic data in that Frontiers paper is wild.
It really is.
During the thick of the COVID-19 lockdowns, the incidence of frozen shoulder saw a 2.41-fold increase. It more than doubled.
Now, a skeptic might say, well, people were locked in their houses. They were sedentary. They stopped going to the gym.
Fair enough. Decreased movement definitely plays a role.
It does. But researchers dug into the psychological profiles of these new patients, and they found a massive psychological multiplier.
This is where it gets crazy.
Individuals suffering from clinical depression had an 8.8 times greater risk of developing a frozen shoulder.
8.8 times. And for individuals with anxiety, it was even higher, a 14 times greater risk. 14.
It's unbelievable. And the psychological state didn't just trigger the onset either.
What do you mean?
The data shows that for patients who actually undergo surgery to physically cut and release that tight capsule, the outcomes are significantly worse if they have underlying anxiety or depression.
Really?
Yeah, their bodies simply refuse to heal properly after the physical release.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because you sent us this Science Direct study, a binational study, looking at 60 patients diagnosed with adhesive capsulitis.
Yes, a very revealing study.
They screened them using the Goldberg scale, which is a rigorous clinical tool for detecting psychological distress. And the numbers are staggering.
They absolutely dismantle the idea that psychological distress is just a rare side effect.
Out of those 60 patients, 6.6% had anxiety alone. Another 6.6% had depression alone. But 71.6% of the patients had both anxiety and depression concurrently.
Over 70%.
Yeah. Only 15% of the frozen shoulder patients had a clear, healthy psychological screening.
What's fascinating here is that this flips the standard clinical view upside down. Anxiety and depression aren't rare complications of a frozen shoulder. They are the dominant clinical feature.
I have to play devil's advocate for you here, though.
Go for it.
Because this feels like the ultimate chicken or egg scenario. If my arm was locked to my side for 8 months and I was waking up screaming every time I rolled over in bed, I reckon I'd test positive for depression and anxiety, too.
Yeah, no, that's a completely valid point.
Are we sure these people aren't just depressed because they are in chronic pain?
That is the crucial question. And obviously, chronic pain absolutely degrades mental health. But recent genetic research gives us a definitive answer regarding causality.
Okay.
Let's look at the bidirectional Mendelian randomization study.
We should probably translate that for you. Mendelian randomization is basically nature's clinical trial, right?
That's a great way to put it. Think of it as a way to use genetic data to prove cause and effect, not just correlation.
Right.
Researchers look at genetic variants that are known to cause a specific trait. In this case, genetic markers strongly linked to anxiety disorders.
Because you're born with your genes, they are influenced by whether you get a frozen shoulder later in life.
Exactly. So if people with the anxiety genes have a much higher rate of frozen shoulder, it proves the anxiety is driving the shoulder condition, not the other way around.
And that is exactly what the study found.
It did. It established a causal pathway from anxiety to adhesive capsulitis.
Wow.
The toxic emotions, the chronic psycho-emotional stress, they are the spark that lights the fire. They trigger a biological cascade that ends with the physical freezing of the joint.
All right, I need you to walk me through the biology of that. How does an emotion, like a fleeting feeling of panic or long-term sadness, turn into thick, fibrous scar tissue in my shoulder?
It comes down to the brain-immune interplay model. To understand how thoughts become scar tissue, we have to start with LGI, or low-grade inflammation.
Now, we hear about inflammation all the time, but LGI is different than twisting your ankle and it's swelling up, right?
Very different. Acute inflammation is a healthy, localized response to an injury. Low-grade inflammation is systemic, and it's driven by the chronic stressors of modern life.
Like what?
Highly processed diets, lack of sleep, and chronic emotional stress. They all keep the body's stress response engaged.
Okay.
Normally, a stress hormone, like cortisol spikes to handle an emergency, puts out the inflammatory fire and then drops back down.
But if you are constantly stressed about work, your mortgage, or, say, a global pandemic, that cortisol is always pumping.
And eventually, your immune cells become resistant to it. They stop listening to the cortisol.
Oh, wow.
The result is a simmering background level of inflammation that never turns off. And this LGI acts like acid on the body's internal borders, the mucosal barriers.
Like the gut lining. We rely on the gut lining to keep the bacteria from our food inside the digestive tract and out of our bloodstream.
Exactly. LGI makes that gut lining permeable. It causes leaky gut, allowing bacterial debris to slip into the blood.
Yikes.
But LGI also degrades an even more critical barrier, the blood-brain barrier.
The shield that's supposed to keep systemic toxins from reaching our brain tissue.
Yep. Once that shield becomes leaky, we set the stage for a massive autoimmune misfire. And this is where we dive into the GAD65 hypothesis.
Let's take this slow, because this completely blew my mind when I read the paper.
It's full on, I know. So GAD65 glutamic acid decarboxylase 65 is an enzyme.
Okay.
It is incredibly important for the brain's GABAergic system. You could think of the GABAergic system as the brain's braking mechanism.
Right.
It's the neurochemical network that regulates fear, stops anxiety loops, and helps you relax. Now, GAD65 is what immunologists call a superauto antigen.
Meaning it's a complex protein that our own immune system is very prone to mistaking for a foreign invader.
Exactly. So imagine someone is under intense emotional distress. Their brain is frantically trying to pump the brakes on the anxiety, so the GABAergic system kicks into overdrive, producing massive amounts of this GAD65 enzyme.
Right.
At the exact same time, this person experiences a minor physical immune challenge.
The sources mention catching a mild viral infection or even something as mundane as oral bacteria entering the bloodstream while you're aggressively brushing your teeth.
Yeah, everyday stuff. So you have a physical immune challenge bacteria in the blood combined with intense psychological stress.
Okay, setting the scene.
The immune system dispatches its security guards, the T cells, to hunt down the bacteria. But remember, the blood-brain barrier is leaky from chronic inflammation.
Wait, so the T cells wander into the brain?
They do. And they encounter this massive flood of GAD65 enzyme. In this chaotic, inflamed environment, the T cells get confused.
Oh, no.
They mistakenly identify the GAD65 as the invading pathogen. The immune system is now primed to attack a natural enzyme that your body needs to function.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this totally solves the diabetes mystery we mentioned earlier, because type 1 diabetics are incredibly prone to frozen shoulders.
It is the missing piece of the puzzle. Type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune condition where the body attacks its own pancreas.
And what protein does the immune system attack in the pancreas? GAD65.
Exactly.
The pancreas uses the exact same enzyme. So, a stressed brain accidentally trains the immune system to hate GAD65. The immune system then travels down to the pancreas, sees the GAD65 there, and destroys the cells, causing type 1 diabetes.
But the immune system doesn't stop there. Once it has these autoantibodies, it circulates through the entire body looking for anything that remotely resembles the target. This is called antigen spreading.
And somehow the shoulder capsule ends up in the crosshairs, usually the non-dominant shoulder too, because it gets less movement and poorer blood flow, making it vulnerable.
That's right.
Let's put this in an analogy so it sticks. Imagine your immune system is a high-tech security system in a massive office building. Your brain is the control room.
Okay, I like this.
Because of chronic stress and anxiety, the control room operators are panicked and exhausted. They start sending out corrupted, faulty intel to the security guards patrolling the building, the T cells.
Yep.
The guards get this bad intel, they get confused, they hit the panic button, and they accidentally trigger a heavy steel lockdown door right on your shoulder joint.
That's a great way to visualize it.
Mm-hmm.
The lockdown is the literal freezing of the joint. The thick scar tissue and the inflammation aren't a mechanical injury.
Right.
They are the body's misguided attempt to wall off and destroy a perceived threat that doesn't actually exist in the shoulder.
It's collateral damage from a security system acting on bad information from a stressed out brain, which means if a frozen shoulder is actually a brain immune glitch, we can't just treat the shoulder joint. Treating the hinge won't fix the corrupted software.
And this is exactly why standard treatments often fail to prevent that chronic, years-long restriction in so many patients.
Let's talk about those standard treatments. If you walk into a clinic today with a frozen shoulder, they'll likely hand you a script for NSAIDs like ibuprofen or naproxen, or give you a corticosteroid injection to kill the inflammation.
Yeah, very common.
But the Frontiers paper drops a massive warning about doing that.
It does. The paper argues that aggressively suppressing inflammation with NSAIDs might actually be deleterious.
Which goes against everything we usually do for pain.
Completely. We've been culturally conditioned to view inflammation as the enemy, but acute inflammation is the cleanup crew. It is a necessary biological phase of resolution and healing.
So if you constantly bombard the joint with anti-inflammatories, you're shooting the cleanup crew. You're stopping the tissue from completing its healing cycle.
You're chemically silencing the fire alarm, but you're also preventing the fire department from doing their job.
Wow.
By halting the inflammation prematurely, you risk trapping the shoulder in a state of suspended animation. You freeze the healing process itself, turning an acute response into a chronic condition.
So what does this all mean? If we shouldn't just be popping painkillers and getting cortisone shots, what's the alternative? How do you fix a software glitch that's manifesting as a frozen arm?
The evidence points to body-first interventions that address the root metabolic and immune causes. You have to lower the background, low-grade inflammation, and patch up those leaky barriers.
The sources highlight immunonutrition as a primary tool. And this isn't just, you know, eating healthy. It's using specific nutrients to manipulate cellular behavior, specifically high doses of omega-3 fatty acids and olive oil phenolics.
Yeah, those specific compounds work at a cellular level to balance the mitochondria and reduce oxidative stress.
Right.
They naturally dial down the volume on the panic response without entirely halting the necessary healing inflammation.
And we have to fix the leaky gut barrier to stop the bacteria from entering the bloodstream in the first place. The research points to targeted probiotics like Lactobacillus plantarum and proteins like lactoferrin, which physically help rebuild the integrity of the gut lining.
But we cannot ignore the physical reality of the shoulder either. Movement remains essential.
Right. The physio still matters.
Definitely. Physiotherapy isn't just about mechanically tearing the scar tissue. It's about preventing movement neglect.
Because when it hurts to move, you start moving it. And when you start moving it, the blood flow drops and oxygen levels in the joint plummet.
And a low oxygen environment in the body is the perfect breeding ground for dormant bacteria to settle in and trigger even more localized inflammation. Movement forces oxygen back into the tissue.
Which brings us to the most bizarre, absolute wildcard therapy in the entire deep dive.
Oh, this is my favorite part.
If oxygen manipulation is key, we have to talk about therapeutic hypercapnia. And to do that, we have to talk about the naked mole rat.
The naked mole rat is a biological marvel.
It's so weird.
It resists cancer, it seems immune to many inflammatory diseases, and it lives incredibly long for a rodent. And researchers noted that these animals live deep underground in massive colonies.
Okay.
In environments with very low oxygen and unusually high levels of carbon dioxide.
So scientists looked at this and thought, what if carbon dioxide isn't just a waste product we exhale? What if it's a biological signal?
Exactly. Researchers have found that inducing a state of mild hypercapnia, which means slightly elevating the carbon dioxide levels in human blood, can have profound therapeutic effects on autoimmune conditions.
And the high-tech medical method for achieving this hypercapnia is plastic bag rebreathing for 90 seconds.
It sounds like a joke, but the physiological response is very real.
Really?
Yeah. Rebreathing your own exhaled air slightly raises your blood CO2. This slight increase rapidly suppresses pro-inflammatory cytokines.
Cytokines being the chemical text messages the immune system uses to call in more troops and cause more inflammation.
Yes. The elevated CO2 intercepts those messages. It calms the overactive immune cells and causes blood vessels to dilate, drastically improving circulation to the starved joint.
Let me make sure I'm translating this right for you. If you go to a progressive clinic with a frozen shoulder, alongside changing your diet and going to the physio, you might actually be instructed to sit on a chair and breathe into a paper bag for a minute and a half to stop your immune system from attacking your own arm.
It is a deliberate biochemical hack.
That's brilliant.
Breathing into a bag directly manipulates the autonomic nervous system. It forces a hard reset of the panic response.
Yeah.
It communicates directly to the brain's control room to stand down the guards, which stops the attack on the shoulder capsule.
It sounds absurd until you understand the mechanics, and then it makes perfect sense. Let's try and summarize this massive shift in perspective for you.
Yep.
For decades, we've treated adhesive capsulitis as a purely mechanical failure. Bad luck, wear and tear, or just a symptom of getting older.
But the data simply doesn't support that outdated model anymore. When over 70% of sufferers are presenting with clinical anxiety and depression, and genetic trials prove anxiety causes the disease, the mind-body link is undeniable.
It is a disease of modern life. Chronic psychological stress, highly processed diets, and sedentary habits create a simmering background of low-grade inflammation.
Right.
That inflammation breaks down our bodily borders, like the gut lining and the blood-brain barrier. Then, when an exhausted, stressed brain meets a minor physical immune challenge, the whole system misfires.
It gets primed against our own proteins, like GAD65.
Yep, and it ends up mistakenly initiating a lockdown on the shoulder joint as collateral damage.
This raises an important question, really. Think about the aches and pains you carry around, the chronic stiffness in your neck, the ache in your lower back that never quite shifts.
Are they purely mechanical issues?
Or is your body keeping a physical score of your mental stress? Are those physical symptoms actually your immune system acting on bad intel from an overwhelmed mind?
It's a profound and slightly intimidating way to look at our health. And it leaves you with a final thought to ponder today.
What's that?
If our modern lifestyle of high stress, constant digital connection, and low physical movement can cause the immune system to literally freeze a major joint in place, what other modern physical ailments are actually just emotional defense mechanisms hiding in plain sight? Could our bodies literally be paralyzing themselves, forcing a physical lockdown simply because we refuse to slow down our minds?
That's a heavy thought.
It really is. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep asking questions, keep challenging the obvious answers, and remember to take care of both your mind and your shoulders.